Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. First, in a few minutes, Sam Gindin, a political economist who spent a long time with the Canadian Auto Workers Union, will talk about why organized labor needs a lively, thoughtful left. And then at the bottom of the hour, Christy Thornton, a graduate student at New York University, will talk about union organizing there and the evolving corporate university. First up, Sam Gindin. Sam, a frequent guest on Behind the News, spent many years as an economic and political advisor at the Canadian Auto Workers Union. He is now a part-time professor at York University in Toronto and co-author, along with Leo Panitch, of The Making of Global Capitalism, recently out in paper from Verso. I spoke with him when I was up in Toronto recently to be on a panel, which he refers to during the interview. Sam Gindin. So, Sam, the left and labor, a long-standing relationship, but not a trouble-free one. I could see how a left would need a labor movement, but you often say that the labor movement needs a left. How is that?
Well, I think it's absolutely critical, and can I give a fairly long answer?
Go ahead. Absolutely.
I think we have to start with the notion of the working class as the confidence in the working class becoming any kind of a revolutionary force, or even a force that's really capable of defending itself. And I think the way it should be understood is that the potential was always there, but there are always contradictions in the working class. And those contradictions involve the fact that they're not only fragmented from each other, but they're very dependent on their employer. They're dependent on capitalism. That's another problem. A different kind of a problem is the fact that they're always under pressure to survive, to make a living. So there's a bias towards the short term. So what that implies is that what workers are really learning on a daily basis is not that they can potentially control society, but that they're actually dependent on the employer. The employer is the one that organizes production, that brings them together, that understands the connections to the markets and to finance and globally. And at the same time, their daily experience, even if there's some unity in the workplace, and often there isn't even that because they're divided along different ages or ethnicities, they're fragmented across workplaces. So the question is, how does this become a social force? And this was always a problem, but in the 50s and 60s it seemed less of a problem because just through the militancy in a workplace, they could make gains, and those gains would often spread to the rest of the working class. What became clear from the early 80s on was that kind of strategy of just having some resources and strength in the workplace wasn't good enough to defend yourself, never mind to really think about social change. And that's where the question of the left comes in, because what the role of the left is, on the one hand, it gives you an analysis that's much broader than what you experience and learn on a daily basis. You may learn that your boss is a bad guy, but you know the role of a left, and that includes left workers who are reading, the role of a left is to give you some sense of the system, that what you're fighting is not just a bad boss, but there's a system out there, that capitalism drives even their own boss towards competitiveness, and you had to understand that. You had to understand the limits of what your action is just in your own workplace so you could think broader. I think that's one thing that the left does, is begin to give you an analysis of the nature of the problem you face. The left also starts connecting you to your own history, because I think workers have lost their own history. You mentioned that in a sense, talking about young people the other day at a forum, but workers generally have lost their own history. And that history is crucial, not just for inspiring people, but from recognizing that workers at certain moments in time actually made strategic decisions to go in a different direction, like the last time we had a crisis this deep in the 30s, rejecting craft unionism and thinking about industrial unionism as a broader form of unionism that was more inclusive, that was more democratic, you know, that begins to teach you lessons about the possibility of workers rethinking where they are at a moment in time and moving in a different direction. So there's a question of regaining your own history, there's a question of analysis, and then there's the really crucial questions of strategy. Workers are really cut off in private lives or even in their own workplace. What the left could do is help them get connections across workplaces. So the left has a role to play in terms of connecting workers, bringing them some resources from outside so they're not just overwhelmed and intimidated by what either the media is saying or their own union leadership is saying. It's an independence. And I think more generally what the left is crucial to is creating that sense of an independent ideology and an independent vision, so they aren't co-opted because of immediate kinds of decisions onto management's agenda and fighting on management's terrain. And that's a really difficult fight because there's all these pressures to willingly be co-opted because there are reforms that look good, but that cost you a lot in the long term, especially if you don't have that kind of a vision. So the left is absolutely critical for all those things. And then there's just the tactical things about pushing people to think about what should the priorities be, because sometimes you can win things, but the real question is, whatever you're winning, it's usually marginal within capitalism, important but marginal. But how do you win things in the sense of building new capacities so that your options are really expanded for future battles? The whole point about unions is to have some independent resources and vision and values from capital, but unions themselves proved unable to keep reproducing that. And the point of a left is that it's partly in the unions, but partly outside the unions, and that gives it some potential to both interact with the real and all the constraints of the real, but also have some distance from it. And that distance, I think, is critical to thinking strategically and tactically and retaining that independence and always fighting for that independence.
A lot of contemporary radicals would view much of what you said as elitist. There's a great belief in spontaneous action from below. Intellectuals are outsiders, cut off from the real world, and the proletariat will only liberate itself. What do you say to that?
Well, the liberation from the proletariat will only ultimately come from itself. One thing is that you do need leadership. I think leadership is absolutely crucial. I mean, even if you're trying to think about how you break out of something, it has to start somewhere, it has to develop someplace. So the leadership is important. But when I say leadership, I'm not just talking about intellectuals from the outside. I'm talking about actually developing workers who can think about these things, who are directly grounded, and intellectuals themselves as having both of, being in touch with workers all the time, so the workers are a check on the leadership as well. You can't just walk into a workplace and pontificate. It's only if you're actually saying something relevant, something that touches a nerve, something that makes sense, something that proves correct through experience, that they will, in fact, listen to you. So the leadership thing, I think, is important, although this is a real tension. You're always trying to balance the question of leadership and really democratizing knowledge. What you're trying to do is, in a sense, make your leadership less crucial over time, because you're really always trying to spread it. You're trying to spread your knowledge, and you're trying to spread those capacities for strategic thinking. So that I don't feel very uncomfortable with. What does make me uncomfortable is the emphasis on spontaneity. I think that's, in fact, dangerous. And there's a lot of elements to the spontaneity. There's the kind of spontaneity that says we don't have to think big, we don't have to worry about the state, we can just protest. You know, take Occupy as an example. As you've talked about Occupy often, Occupy shows that audacious action matters. Well, that's great. I thought that was a great thing that they showed. Audacious action kind of speaks crudely about class, and I thought that was positive. They're at least, starting to raise something and show it's actually possible to put that on the agenda. But when you make those things into some total of your politics, it just has nowhere to go. There's no way for that to actually begin to do the kind of outreach to the working class. So it's the working class that is occupying things, not just Occupy. And it's the working class that are occupying things that aren't just symbolic. It goes both ways. I think it was a great failure of the trade union movement, even when it supported Occupy and gave it some resources, that what it wasn't doing was really demonstrating that it's workers who can take over government buildings and schools and factories, and therefore that they actually, demonstrating to others that they actually have the power to do things, and not just symbolic things, and not just protest, which always comes to an end. So part of this problem is that the working class itself over the last 20 or 30 years hasn't inspired young people that they're crucial, that the working class is crucial to social change, which makes it difficult. So the problem with spontaneity is, either it does something good but defines that as the sum total of politics rather than as the beginning of politics, which is a problem, and that it ultimately doesn't address the really complicated questions of, you're fighting this incredibly powerful system. and how do you address questions of state, how you organize yourself, how are you really going to take this on and really make change as opposed to fight on the margins?
I'm speaking with Sam Gindin, who spent many years with the Canadian Auto Workers Union. There were a bunch of radicals in the 60s and 70s who tried industrializing. You know, they went to work in factories and were going to organize the working class. I don't think that turned out so well. How does that relate to the strategy you're thinking of?
Look, that's a good question because, you know, I'm thinking of people that I met that went through that experience, and I can't think of a lot of examples where it really worked out well. Sometimes it actually taught those radicals how difficult making change was possible, and I think it grounded them in the working class. In those cases, I can think of a lot of examples that were positive. Some good trade union leaders actually emerged from that experience. But I don't think it's a question of going into the workplace and thinking that just by you being there, that solves the problem. I think the question is, how do you actually relate to workers so that you can engage them in struggles, challenge them, be supportive? It is this trick of having a foot in the labor movement and a foot outside and recruiting. Workers develop unevenly. Some workers develop quite rapidly. Recruiting those kinds of workers and creating spaces where they can engage in broader struggles that go beyond the workplace, that raise larger questions. So I don't think the answer is that anybody who's a lefty should be going into the workplace and saying, this is the answer. I think wherever you are, there are things that you could be doing. Some of them may, in fact, be in workplaces. But I think that wherever you are, there are things that you can do intellectually as a media person, but it does require you. I mean, the working class has to be a check on you, so your arguments aren't abstract, and so you can learn how to deal with real people all the time. But, you know, the question for me now is that in the absence of a party, you can't just proclaim a socialist party. It comes out of a certain level of struggle and a certain level of conflict in society. And we've had this defeat for 30 years where people just don't think things are possible. So we're starting so small. What do you do at these moments of time? I guess that's what I'm kind of struggling with. And the way we've been trying to struggle with it is, that, you know, one of the critical things is that the working class has to have a class perspective. What does that mean in terms of what we do? So we're trying to do educationals that develop rank and file leaders who aren't just focused on how do I replace my own leader, but are focused on how to think through strategic class issues and what they would mean for struggle. So, for example, if you're in the public sector, the key to the public sector isn't just to be more militant. It's to figure out how do we demonstrate that the public sector is actually the leader in the fight for social services? How do we deal with the fact that we're actually confronting the state directly? How do we deal with the fact that we're in danger of being isolated because workers' taxes pay our wages? So how should we shape our struggles to make that clearer? How do we get workers together across workplaces so they can start talking about this, you know, this problem and how they're dealing with it? How do we create spaces that don't just deal with workers as being in a particular collective bargaining unit, but actually bring workers together as activists who are unionized or non-unionized and who also see that their life in the community in terms of what's happening with schools and what's happening to healthcare, what's happening with the environment, is actually a class question. It's not just a question of the community is a good place to be for charitable reasons or we need the community in an instrumental way so we're not isolated. It's classes in all those dimensions. So we've been trying to create, to raise those kinds of questions and create some spaces for doing that. And it's really difficult. One of the difficult, do you want me to
write? You go ahead.
Well, just to throw out some of the, we created an assembly in Toronto, and we saw it as a space where everybody kind of agrees that the focus has to be on class, really broadly defined. We kind of came to an agreement that it has to be open to anti-capitalism, and we defined that kind of loosely because we saw that as something we really want to talk about. What does that mean? Does that mean you're against big business or against finance or against global companies, or does it mean you're actually talking about capitalism? We didn't see it as a coalition where everybody has their own identity and is only coming there to see what does this do for me. Rather, we saw it as individual members coming to try to create a new layer of politics. And the problems we got into is, one is that at a moment of not many struggles going on, it's actually to find the places to engage workers. If there aren't a lot of struggles going on, you can't meet them on the picket line. I mean, if you can't be arguing for a different kind of a strategy, that's a limit. That's been one limit that we've had. We've had the limit of a generation of young people who have faded from the left into either different politics or just into no politics at all. So a lot of the people that have been involved have been older, a lot of us white males. That's been a problem. We've had the problem of identity politics, because if you're going to try to develop, one of the critical things is how do you create socialists so you can keep the idea of socialism alive? And to do that kind of education, you need some consensus about what your politics is. And instead, we're finding that, you know, we found that there were so many divisions around whether the key was identity politics or a class politics. And as long as you're fighting those battles, well, you know, which are ironic at a moment in time when neoliberalism is so fragmenting the working class, identity politics has also served to keep parsing the working class rather than uniting it, even though there have always been failings of the left and of the working class that people who started talking about race and gender raised some important things. You know, it's been hard to develop a new cadre of socialists because of our own divisions, because of the weakness of the left, and I think a real lack of organizing skills, we found at least, that we just don't know how to do it because we're actually trying to figure it out again. How do you reach people in a moment in time when, on the one hand, they've been more and more integrated into neoliberalism? I mean, that contradiction in the working class, which makes you dependent all the time and co-opts you, neoliberalism really exploited by channeling people into finding individual ways of survival. And with the left not being able to find, you know, and unions not giving them collective expression, people did find individual ways. You know, they work longer hours, go into debt, play off the assets they have in terms of a home, hope for a higher stock market. All those things meant you're fighting for individual forms of survival. You're hoping for a lower income tax because that's like a wage increase. And your collective capacities atrophy. So we've suffered from that. And then there's a sense of fatalism where people know that things suck, but they don't really believe that there's a way of changing it because we haven't created those structures that give them that confidence. It's going to take a lot to get out of this kind of 30 years of defeat. I think that we really have to appreciate how profound this defeat has been. And you put it in terms of a new generation of people who've never seen anything else, which is amazing. But I see it also in, you know, my generation of workers, because they went from actually feeling that they had some power to learning how powerless they were. And it was a very profound defeat. So we also have to overcome that fatalism. And so I guess my main argument is that I think organization is crucial. People will usually say, well, the only way you can overcome fatalism is to have some small victories. My experience with small victories is that when you have a small victory and it ends, you can get just as demoralized. Because you know what? You know,
is that all there is?
Yeah, is that all there is? You know, I've seen, you know, we've had fantastic demos, which were just unbelievable. They were shockingly great. And, you know, people wake up the next day and they say, now what? And, you know, one of the lessons is, well, it's about building. You know, nothing's changing because we don't have that power. And just getting out in the street and having a protest, it's great if it brings people into politics and introduces people into politics and raises questions. But it has to be seen as the beginning of building. And that's why I think this question of organizing is so important, because organizing means giving people the confidence that there are structures through which they can work and fight, and over time they can become cumulative. We're on the way to something, and there's a sense of community. And that's what we haven't been able to build. I just think it's, you know, it's an incredibly difficult thing. I think it's going to take experimentation. So I think it's very important we look at everything that's happening around Europe, and in things like Workers' Action Center, what do we learn from everything, rather than getting deflated every time we do an experiment and it doesn't work?
You mentioned the 30s, and many decades ago, we were people lived densely in urban neighborhoods and worked in large factories, they were sort of collected in one place that made it somewhat easier. The social ties were there, but also it also made it easier to talk to people. Yeah. They're much more dispersed now. Yeah. The nature of the workplace is different. There's an awful lot of turnover in the workforce. How do you deal with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the characteristics of neoliberalism was that it was this massive restructuring, and that restructuring strengthens the capitalist class. Maybe we can particular capitalists who go under, but the capitalist class comes out stronger because the stronger survive and they absorb the rest, and the capitalist class doesn't actually have to worry as much about whether jobs are shifting from Detroit to the South. Their class power, their unity through Wall Street, you know, their offices in New York are still kind of together. So not a problem for them. For the working class, it's been a major problem, that kind of restructuring. You know, I look at, you know, a place like Windsor, an auto town. There's three generations of workers who live there. And, you know, in addition to what you said about communities, it took generations to develop a kind of a sense of working class and confidence in the working class. My grandfather worked there. You know, my great-grandfather was involved in the sit-down strike. And when you disperse these people, especially when there isn't a real socialist movement or socialist culture, they're not moving out and bringing new insights and bringing socialism to others. It's just dissipating. So I think this question is very important. And we found here in Toronto, for example, you know, when we start thinking about building the left and building it in Toronto, we soon find out that a lot of the left lives in Toronto. A lot of the people we want to talk to lives in the suburbs. I think that there still is, you know, in a lot of cities, you know, a core of people who are still in the city that if you had the right strategies, you can still mobilize. I do think that, you know, the left has to get out into these working class suburbs and think about getting a better feel for where people are really at in those suburbs. We've got a free transit campaign, for example, and we've been pushed to do this. We found out that you can't actually deal with the question of transit and mobilize people unless you're talking to people who are living out in the suburbs and coming in, or their work is out there. So I think what you're really flagging is another dimension of how difficult the problem is today, why you need to take the question of organization seriously. I mean, it may be that the way we build is by building in different communities or sub-communities, like going into a major suburb and trying to build a mini-assembly there that addresses the questions there, brings people together there. And as you build these mini-assemblies, they come up against the fact that, well, you can't solve the problem in that community. You have to federate into larger places. But I think it pushes us to do that kind of organizing. It may change the way we face issues. I mean, we used to be able to assume that workers are going to be, you know, be living in the same workplace, would want pensions. Maybe it affects how we look at a lot of the social issues that we address. Pensions, for example, maybe the question of universal pensions becomes a very important way of uniting a workforce that isn't going to work in the same place, that's going to have a very sporadic history, but the notion of a universal pension could be very important. I might be very suspicious when you just put it on the table as a policy, but if they really saw unions fighting for this and then joined them in fighting for this, it seems to me that you begin to learn things about potentials and who your allies are and the possibilities of kind of getting away from around how lousy your life is and how uncertain it is through those kinds of things. So maybe we have to think about what should our priorities be in terms of demands? And I think the emphasis on class keeps coming back to how we reach other people rather than just try to reach union people. The dispersal thing, I think there's a lot to emphasize in terms of things like public transit. I think it's a particular issue that we really need to deal with. I guess I'm just desperate for the kind of questions that you're raising and that we're struggling with to be the kind of questions that need to be taken seriously on the left. So my greatest frustration with unions isn't just the particular concessions they're making, but I don't find them seriously saying, we've really got a problem here. We really have to rethink everything. It's always about what's the next gimmick that can maybe help us through it. And my problem with the left is that often when they look at unions, for example, they explain everything in terms of union bureaucrats. And there's obviously some relevance to that explanation. But what they are avoiding is there's really a problem with the rank and file, too. I mean, this is a really deep problem. So we have to deal with something much more complicated than just how do we replace a few bad labor leaders. And the question of politics, we keep getting trapped into thinking of it in terms of electoral politics. We criticize it, and then when there's an opening, we think that, well, maybe if we could jump in and get involved in electoral politics, things will change. And what we're not recognizing, that politics is about building the class as a social force. That's what we have to be thinking about. And elections can have a role in that, but that has to be a priority. So I'm struggling with these questions that you're raising. I don't have answers to them. I'm just hoping that, you know, we actually take these problems much more seriously, and I think that's beginning to happen. So we really learn from them, and that we're ready to experiment and learn from experiments that are going on. You know, there's interesting stuff happening in Greece. There's a big debate going on in England about forming a party to the left of the Labour Party. And the question is, will that just turn out to be kind of another limp Social Democratic Party over time? Or is this somehow a dynamic that, even if it fails, will, you know, raise new questions? I think all these things are important and interesting, and I hope in the not-too-distant futures, you know, real concrete, material responses begin to come out of them.
That was Sam Gindin, who spent many years as an economic and political advisor to the Canadian Auto Workers Union. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Metric by Ellen, Aline and Apparat. Next up is Christy Thornton. She's a graduate student at NYU and active in union organizing at that paradigm of the corporate university. Here she is to tell us about academia today and their organizing efforts. Christy Thornton. Welcome, Christy. First, let's set the stage for goings-on at NYU by talking about the general corporatization of the university. I imagine listeners may be familiar with the broad outlines, but what's been happening with the American University over the last decade or two?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. There's a school of thought that thinks that corporatization of the university isn't the way that we should be conceiving of this, that, you know, obviously universities have long been kind of imbricated in capitalism. But what you've seen, the upward move that neoliberalism has brought means increasing levels of pay and sort of levels of bureaucracy in the administration. So you've seen a real shift in what the university spends its money on, sort of upward, away from the faculty, away from the teaching, and two levels of administration. NYU has something like 35 people with vice president in their title. So you've seen just increasing layers of bureaucracy in the administration and increasing levels of compensation for those people. So when you look at the 990 of most private universities, which are nonprofits, that's the tax form that they file where they have to list their top 10 highest paid employees. The amount that these people in the administration is getting paying is just massive. And at the same time, you've seen especially faculty salaries just stagnating, you know, not even keeping up with inflation. In addition to that, of course, is the rising level of tuition. The way that that's sustained in a lot of universities, and NYU is definitely one of those, is massive increases in tuition. So you've seen increases of, on average, something like 50% in tuition costs over the last decade. At NYU, it's actually much higher than that. It's 68% between 2002 and 2012. So what that means, of course, is increasing student debt, and that's a huge part of this move in the universities in general. Students are just much, much more indebted than they were 10 or 20 years ago now.
When you started talking, I've been thinking for some time that one of the things that have characterized our neoliberal era is just the disappearance of any kind of mediating structure. So the university used to be maybe one or two removes from the capitalist system.
Right.
Now it's just like a straight business proposition.
Yeah. So when people say the corporatization of the university, what they really mean is the governance structure, that the way universities are now run is really similar to the way corporations are run. And of course, at big universities like NYU in a city like New York, what that means is that the board of trustees is entirely investment bankers and real estate people. And so those people sit as the kind of fiduciary body that oversees the university. And so their interests are the interests that really drive what happens at the university. And that's true in private and public universities across the country. And so in addition to those people, the sort of fire industries kind of running the boards of trustees of these universities, you also see a shift in how universities are actually governed. And so the ideal of kind of faculty governance, of the faculty being the people who in some ways run the university, you know, faculty members will stay on for a while, they sort of work their way up to being a dean, but the deans are people who've been in the trenches teaching. And so what you've seen is a kind of shift. You've seen a professionalization of that level of administration and a real difference between the general sort of stratum of the faculty and the administrative levels. And
Which is also happening in primary and secondary education.
I'm sure. And so in that way, when people talk about the corporatization of education, that's what they mean, that increasingly universities come to be structured like corporations and come to be run with the bottom line in mind, right? And so things like the intellectual property that's being produced out of certain departments, or whether departments are costing too much money, right? Whether there's too high of a level of faculty salaries in one department as opposed to another. I mean, you just saw some small colleges, including a college in Washington, D.C., cutting entire programs like English and history, because they don't bring in money the way that some of the sort of research-based ones, where you can get big national grants to do intellectual property-based research. So in that way, the bottom line of what the university does really comes down to how much money it's bringing in. And that is a real shift, I think.
How much difference is there between what's going on at public and private universities?
This shift towards this corporate governance model is definitely deeper and faster in private universities, but you've seen it definitely in public universities as well. And especially in the context of, you know, the decline of state budgets, this is one of the first things that gets cut in state budgets.
And then the fancy ones like Virginia and Michigan are now like only 10 or 15% state funded.
They're essentially being
privatized.
Right, being privatized and doing so exactly through these kinds of grant-making focuses on places that will bring in new kind of research that can be monetized, right? That can be patented and monetized for the university.
Now let's talk more specifically about NYU. Unlike, say, Yale or Harvard, it does not have a large endowment, right?
Right.
So it's very tuition dependent.
Yeah, NYU's endowment per student is something incredibly tiny compared to Yale or Harvard or even Columbia. And so that is something that the administration points to all the time for why there is this kind of this dependence on tuition. At the same time, of course, the fundraising that has happened has gone towards things like the massive expansion plan and not towards raising the endowment, right? And so Sexton has been, one of the things that Sexton is known for is his...
Sexton, university president.
The president of NYU, John Sexton, yeah. One of the things that he's known for is being a tremendous fundraiser, that in his decade at NYU, he's been a very successful fundraiser. And yet, none of that fundraising has gone into this endowment and into changing that student-to-endowment ratio to make it so that there could be more financial aid.
Yeah, I don't want to get carried away with this, but, you know, Harvard and Yale do offer a lot of aid to students, so there's less debt involved.
Exactly.
But NYU is like the world capital of student debt now, isn't it?
NYU has one of the highest levels of student debt in the country. The average student at NYU graduates with 40% more student debt than an average U.S. college student, and that's something like $35,000. The average college student in the United States graduates with something like $24,000. At NYU, it's up at $35,000. And NYU has the highest total student debt taken in aggregate of any college in the country. And the numbers are really actually incredible. In 2002, it cost something like $28,000 a year to go to NYU just for the tuition. By 2012, that was up around $45,000. It was something like a 68% increase in just the tuition, let alone the sort of fees and room and board and those sorts of things. So NYU is now constantly right there at number one or number two as the most expensive colleges in the country. And unlike a place like Harvard or even at Columbia, which is not the greatest in terms of financial aid, there just isn't the level of financial aid for students. And so you see these incredible levels of debt. So the way in which NYU relies on tuition is absolutely at the heart of the model that Sexton has been pushing, because the money that he's been raising has not been going into that endowment and has not been going into student financial aid.
Sorry to ask such a crude question, but is it worth all that money? Is it worth all the debt?
there are people, parents who have prospective students to ask if they should go to NYU. You know, NYU offers some really tremendous resources. But unless you are fabulously wealthy and this education is not going to put you into debt, I don't see why parents want to send their students to these schools. There are schools in New York City where they're going to get higher levels of financial aid or much lower levels of tuition. And so I think just from a sheer financial point of view, not saying anything about the level of education, which, you know, the faculty at NYU are tremendous people and there are incredible resources there. But unless you're fabulously wealthy, I don't see how you can send your kid to NYU. NYU has a huge student body. There's something like 40,000 students. And increasingly what we've seen is this this concentration of the students being these people who have incredible amounts of money. And that is in some ways what the global expansion plan is about.
Yeah, that's the next thing I wanted to talk about. Instead of building up the endowment and being able to offer financial aid and, you know, assistance to other educational programs, Sexton's NYU looks like some sort of crazy corporate conglomerate that's just hell-bent on expansions. What's behind? And then, of course, he wants to expand all over, like, lower Manhattan.
Yeah.
What's behind that? Is this empire building, or is there a strategy behind it? How's your analysis?
There are people who think that this is just expansion for expansion's sake, and this is part of the kind of corporate mentality and corporate governance model that has infected the university, the idea that growth is necessary for survival, that the university must grow to survive. What the underlying logic is there, I'm not exactly sure. But so what you've seen is NYU has developed this model called the Global Network University. No longer will NYU just be based in New York. They've opened this campus in Abu Dhabi. They're opening this new one in Shanghai now. And it seems like they're going to continue to replicate this model over and over again.
I'm speaking with Christy Thornton, who is a graduate student at NYU, active in union organizing efforts there.
And the domestic expansion through lower Manhattan, because of the lack of an endowment, this is essentially being financed by borrowing against future tuition revenues.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only thing we can assume because they won't tell us. NYU as a private institution doesn't have open books. We have no idea what the books look like, right? We can see the tax filing every year, but what's in that is very small. And when they were asked by people on the Faculty Senate Council and other faculty how NYU was going to pay for this, the only answer we ever got was from an administration spokesperson who only said, NYU is not afraid of debt. And so activists in what became NYU Faculty Against the Sexton Plan, together with student groups and the union that I'm a part of, started trying to kind of crunch the numbers. And the only thing we could come up with was exactly that, was financing based on future tuition revenues. And as we've seen the tuition climb so incredibly over the last decade, it is impossible to imagine what levels the tuition might actually reach if they have to finance a $6 billion expansion plan based on future revenue coming from tuition.
Now let's turn to the union. NYU has now, for about a decade, been the site of graduate student organizing. Tell us that history.
Yeah, so I'm a member of the Graduate Student Organizing Committee, GSOC, which in 2001, after about a two-year organizing campaign in 2001, NYU became the first private university in the country to have a recognized graduate worker union. Graduate worker unions are pretty normal in a lot of states for public colleges because those things are governed by state law. But in the private universities, there is no such compulsion by the state laws for there to be unionization for the graduate workers. And graduate workers are, of course, people who teach classes, who are research assistants, who are kind of program assistants for various kinds of academic departments and that sort of thing. So in 2000,
to be clear, the thing couldn't run without graduate student labor.
The thing absolutely could not run without graduate student labor, and that that has historically been true across the university. And universities like CUNY, the vast majority of the teaching gets done by people in the graduate programs. And so at NYU, because of this union struggle, that's become less and less true. They've sort of made their reliance on graduate teachers less, but that has meant their reliance on other kinds of adjunct teachers is more. But so some of the history, in 2001, we became the first union. The NLRB ruled in our favor. The NLRB, at the end of the Clinton administration, put out a ruling that said, yes, that graduate employees were, under labor law, employees, that we were workers, and forced...
Previously, there's this sort of deviously romantic model of apprenticeship.
Right, exactly. So the idea, the romantic notion that you know, graduate students work with their advisors, with their PhD advisors in this apprenticeship model, that it's really all about learning and not about labor. And so that had been the kind of the model that the university was relying on and really pushing. The NLRB said, no, actually, graduate workers are indeed employees under labor law, and forced the university to recognize the union. The university tried to fight back, but eventually we won a contract. So the graduate workers had a contract at NYU from 2001 to 2005. But of course, then the political winds shifted and the Bush administration came in. And the NLRB under the Bush administration, the appointees that Bush put in, were much less amenable to this graduate student organizing. So when the graduate workers at Brown University brought a petition before the NLRB to recognize their union, the Bush NLRB overturned it. And so that was in 2004. So when our contract came up in 2005, the university refused to renegotiate. And there was a strike that lasted almost a year. Graduate students walked off the job. Faculty held their classes off of campus. It was a huge battle between the university and the graduate workers. But that strike, sort of lasting over the course of two academic semesters, eventually the university held out and they won. So as of the end of the 2005-2006 academic year, the union wasn't recognized, the contract was over, the organizing was really at a low point. It was a really difficult point.
Now, this apprenticeship model might have had some material basis when graduate students could have a future of being professors themselves,
yeah,
and earning fairly healthy salaries.
Right.
That, of course, is no longer the normal future.
Definitely no longer the case. So when the strike was broken, the union kind of regrouped and started getting back together. So when I entered in 2009, there was the beginnings of a new organizing campaign. Something really interesting happened in the interim, which was part of this sort of larger vision that involves the expansion plans, the increasing use of adjunct labor, this increasing administration salaries and sort of levels of administrative bloat. The university changed the way it funds the graduate students at NYU. So we are really relatively well compensated. Relatively is obviously the operative word, because we live and work in New York City, the most expensive place to live and work in the country. So, but with the gains that we won with the previous contract, we're pretty okay as far as graduate students are concerned. But we saw those gains continue to be eroded over the period. Massive 33% increase in healthcare costs last year alone. So, but the university did this thing where they basically made it so that when you enter to become a graduate student at NYU now in the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, you're no longer required to teach. Traditionally, the way graduate school has always worked is you come in and they say, okay, you have to teach this many semesters out of your total semesters, and then you will get paid for that. NYU, because they saw the Obama administration coming in and they thought the NLRB might reverse its decision again, basically took the teaching part out of being a grad student. They said, now you get paid. When you come in, we offer you 5 years of funding, and you don't have to teach in that to get the money. And when you do teach, you get paid the adjunct rate, and go ahead and join the adjuncts union. They were basically trying to foreclose the ability for us to make any claim to have the graduate student union in general. So for a lot of people, it seemed like a really good deal. All of a sudden, to get your money, you're not required to teach. And then when you do teach, you get paid above and beyond that. That seemed like a real coup for the administration. It seemed like they had really kind of figured out how to break the union and make it so that the new incoming graduate students would have no sort of personal vested interest in being in the union because their deal was so good. But one of the interesting things that it did was it actually opened the door for a new petition before the NLRB. Because when the university said, okay, go ahead and join the adjuncts union for the work that you do, they were admitting that we were workers, which was something that they didn't want to admit before. So that started the new NLRB petition that we had been working on for the past couple of years before this agreement came into.
So where are you at now?
Through campaigning sort of publicly and behind the scenes, and because of the increased scrutiny on NYU for all of these, what I've been calling the kind of Sexton vision, these expansion plans, all these various things, the increased scrutiny on NYU and the bad publicity that NYU had come to have put the union in a really strong position vis-a-vis the administration. And the UAW, which is the union that is the kind of parent union of GSOC, sat down with Sexton and they came to an agreement. And the university agreed that they would let us hold an election if we withdrew the NLRB petition. So they didn't want the precedent to be set in the national labor law, but they said, we will recognize the union if you win the election. So they let us schedule an election. We scheduled an election. We won 98.4% of the people who came out to vote. 620 people voted yes. 620 people voted yes. 10 people voted no for union representation. So the question is kind of, what about the NLRB petition, right? What about the representation, the overturning this precedent in the labor law? We think that obviously we're going to set new kinds of precedents for what can happen at private universities sort of outside the bounds of that. But we've also seen the way in which the NLRB can just be used as a political football, kind of punted back and forth in what is an increasingly rancorous partisan fight in Washington. You know, we saw the Clinton era NLRB recognize us, the Bush era NLRB overturn us. Then when it became clear that the NLRB was going to grant our hearing of a petition under Obama, the university tried to get one of the members of the board to recuse herself because of previous affiliation with the UAW. The kind of partisan fighting that's happening in Washington right now makes these moves at the NLRB very, very difficult and also makes them very tenuous. You know, you could have the board decide at one point that you are workers and then 3 years later have that be overturned. So this is a really interesting precedent where the university has itself voluntarily recognized the union, said, if you win the election, we will recognize you, we'll sit down and negotiate, we'll draw up a contract. And now we're doing that.
Well, why this softness coming from them?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Why the reversal? You know, during the strike, John Sexton, the president, told one of the graduate organizers that GSOC, our union, was a virus that had to be extirpated from campus. So it's a pretty stunning reversal for all of a sudden now his spokespeople to come out and say the union makes NYU a stronger and more competitive university. Personally, I think that it's because of the larger political climate in which John Sexton finds himself now. He's besieged on all sides. There's a Senate investigation into the finances, you know, because they, NYU does things like when Jack Lew, who was the executive vice president at NYU during the strike, Jack Lew was NYU's strike breaker in chief. He was the executive vice president charged with breaking the union during the strike. Of course, he's now the treasury secretary. When he left NYU voluntarily to go work for Citibank, NYU gave him a $685,000 exit bonus.
Because no doubt he is making a great sacrifice by going to work for Citibank. Right?
Going to Citibank, and you know, obviously it's about the revolving door between finance and the administration, and being able to keep those windows kind of open and people passing back and forth. So, you know, there's a Senate investigation going on now about those.
And then
there's
the buying houses.
Yeah. So not only is NYU giving these exit bonuses, they're financing the mortgages for not just primary residences, but vacation houses for some of the star faculty in the medical and law schools and some of the top administrators. Sexton has an NYU financed vacation house on Fire Island. And so when these things started coming out, the organizing that had been done by the faculty against the expansion plan in New York, plus this broader media scrutiny, plus the union fight, it was clear that we were just in a position of strength vis-a-vis Sexton at this point. He's besieged on all sides. Sexton has, from the beginning, had this idea that NYU needs to be a leader in higher education. The things that he does should be a model for higher education elsewhere. And getting beat at the NLRB would have been a real blow to that. And so my personal opinion is that this allowed him to kind of to take the reins a little bit and say, we did this amazing thing at this university. We came to this negotiation. It allowed him to sort of retake the leadership on this a bit. And the university has used the language that we've been using the whole time, that the union makes our work more stable, more secure, makes for better graduate students, makes NYU a better place to go to graduate school. For them, what that means is it's a more competitive university because everything has to be subject to the logic of the market in that way on their side. They were basically forced by this series of criticisms of what is this underlying vision that breaking the union was about to concede that our fight was not a fight that they were going to win. And so we will now enter into contract negotiations and have the first contract once again of private university graduate workers in the country.
And then to conclude by getting back to the big picture, does what's been happening at NYU have any implications for changing the face of academic labor or the corporatization of the university?
I think it absolutely does. GSOC, the union, has been receiving messages from all of the other private campaigns that are going on now. There's a big one at the University of Chicago, at Yale. They're restarting at Columbia. So lots of other private university graduate workers are really buoyed by this decision. And, you know, there was a University of Chicago organizer who told Al Jazeera America that this has put options on the table that they didn't even know were possible, right? So there might be a new move for graduate workers. But one thing that we've heard from the faculty who've been involved in this fight against the Sexton vision and for sort of more shared governance is that this should actually serve as a way for, as a precedent for faculty to begin to organize in this way too. So not only the contingent faculty, the adjunct organizing, which is happening at NYU and the New School and CUNY, there's a new move to have union representation for those people as well, but actually for the faculty to begin to organize sort of beyond the structures of the American Association of University Professors, which is just a professional organization, right? So this could really open avenues for people to organize at academic labor beyond graduate workers, and I think could really begin to change the idea that expansion for expansion's sake, relentless growth, increasing relying on tuition and massive indebtedness is the way to move the university forward. This could really be a new moment in especially private higher education, but higher education in general in this country.
That was Christy Thornton, a graduate student in history at NYU who is very active in union organizing efforts there. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, something to meld the Canadian and New York content of the previous two interviews. Metric, with a guest appearance by Lou Reed, doing The Wanderlust, which they distressingly pronounce with an Anglo W. Till next week, bye.